This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In Britain, the bitter dispute over the decision to go to war in Iraq was transformed by the apparent suicide of scientist and weapons expert David Kelly. An official inquiry into his death has developed into an investigation of both the government and the BBC, with enormous implications for both. Last fall, the government presented the public with a document that detailed its case for war, focusing on the threat of weapons of mass destruction. It included an allegation that Saddam Hussein's armies could deploy chemical weapons on 45 minutes' notice. In the event, no weapons of mass destruction have been found in Iraq. After the war, BBC correspondent Andrew Gilligan reported that the government had deliberately manipulated intelligence to exaggerate the threat. He quoted an anonymous senior intelligence official as saying that the 45-minute charge was inserted by Prime Minister Tony Blair's communications director to sex up the dossier. Amid huge controversy, Iraqi weapons expert David Kelly was revealed as Gilligan's source. Kelly appeared before a parliamentary committee, and a few days later, he was found dead in the woods near his home. A senior judge, Lord Hutton, is in charge of the inquiry into his death. Last week, testimony focused on the BBC. This week, the government. Communications Director Alistair Campbell appeared today. The credibility and the future of a once popular prime minister and the world's best-known broadcaster may be at stake. If you have questions about the investigation or about the relationship between the government and the BBC, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from London with an update on the inquiry is the editor of Time Magazine Europe, Eric Pooley, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Oh, thank you very much.
What did we learn today from Alistair Campbell's testimony?
Well, it was another extraordinary day. It was day six of the inquiry, and what's interesting is the view that this gives us into the inner workings of Downing Street. Just to backtrack, one day yesterday we learned how intimately involved in this whole thing Tony Blair and his senior staff had been, tracking every development. Blair talking about what Kelly was likely to testify to Parliament before he testified. Today, Alistair Campbell, as you said, went forward, and Campbell denied completely having anything to do. He said no input, no output, anything at all to do with inserting the statement that weapons of mass destruction were ready for use within 45 minutes. But there was other information that tended to call into question Campbell's assertion. In email communication with Mr. Jonathan Scarlett, who is the top intelligence officer in Britain, there was discussions of improving on the question of how to characterize Iraq's capability. Scarlett seems to want to make it weaker, saying we can't improve on the word might. This is in an email to Campbell. Campbell asked about that today, denied having requested, quote, improving on the word might. But in the event, when the dossier was finally published last September, it didn't say might. It said that the Iraqi military, quote, are able to deploy chemical or biological weapons within 45 minutes. So, in fact, the dossier was improved on. The email from Scarlett indicates that Campbell may have requested that improvement, but Campbell denies doing so. So it's a little murky, but what really is clear is that Downing Street was intimately involved in preparing this dossier, right down to the language. Their defenders now in London are saying, well, this is appropriate. It was a major government document, so of course the press office would be involved. And the many attackers are saying, well, they were inappropriately involved, not just in clear presentation of intelligence material, but in spinning and strengthening what that intelligence material said.
Well, Alistair Campbell is a lot more than Tony Blair's press secretary. He formerly held that position as well. He's a longtime associate and a very close advisor.
He's one of the co-architects of New Labour, if you will. He was a tabloid journalist at one point in his career. He jumped over before Blair, working for Neil Kinnock in the Labour government, And then went to work for Blair, and was really been with Blair all along. And so he is a vociferous advocate on behalf of Blair, and the man who Britain believes is sort of co-responsible with Blair for making this government too obsessed with spin. It's a bit like Americans viewed the Clinton administration in its last days. Not that we know that these are the last days of the Blair administration, because I don't think that's at all clear. But the obsession with spin is the Achilles heel of this administration, as it was of Clinton's.
And before we get a lot of emails, you clearly misspoke. Neil Kinnock was the leader of the Labor Party, but never made it into government.
So indeed. I'm sorry.
No Kinnock government.
I wasn't even aware of that, but
well,
clearly yes.
The inquiry this week, as we're saying, is focusing on the government. Last week's testimony about the inner workings of the British Broadcasting Corporation did not make the BBC come out exactly brilliantly either.
What you have is two organizations, both of which had deep internal divisions over the material that it was publishing, but presented a unanimous face to the public. The government chief of staff, Mr. Jonathan Powell, yesterday said that the dossier did not make the case that there was an immediate threat by Iraq. And he clearly thought that they were overstating things. Last week, as you say, the BBC's internal divisions over the report by its defense reporter Andrew Gilligan came out. We had the BBC publicly defending this and privately arguing about whether it was defensible, because Gilligan seems to have sexed up one point in his piece. Of course, sexing up is what he accused Downing Street of doing. Basically, the issue here is whether Campbell himself was responsible for inserting the 45-minute claim, as Gilligan says. Kelly, before he died, told others, including one BBC reporter, that he had used Campbell generically to stand for the Downing Street press operation. And Gilligan fingered Campbell, it's worth saying, not in his initial report on the BBC, but in an article that he wrote a couple of days later for the Mail on Sunday, he fingered Campbell by name as the culprit. And this is what really set Alistair Campbell off on a rampage against the BBC and set this whole thing into motion. But it seems that the BBC report itself may have been a bit flawed. We're still sorting out exactly what Campbell did. He may not have been responsible for inserting the 45-minute claim personally.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. And we have a call from Jeff in his car in Los Angeles.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yep, you're on the air.
Okay, great. I don't want to divert attention from this, but is Scotland Yard investigating the possibility that this was not a suicide?
The Vince Foster scenario. Is this murder or suicide? Is there any evidence either way on this, Eric Pooley?
Well, the evidence, it's still being called an apparent suicide, and part of what Lord Hutton's inquiry is doing is to look into the circumstances surrounding his death. They're beginning in the beginning and working through toward the death itself, but what we do know is that 2 days after Kelly testified before a parliamentary committee, he left his house for an afternoon walk. He did not wear his coat, even though the weather was unpleasant. And the following day, the police found his body in a field. He had ingested painkillers, and his left wrist had been slit. By all accounts, it was a suicide. There's no evidence that anyone else was involved, or if there is such evidence, it has been well repressed. But it's not really a... The idea of it being anything other than a suicide hasn't really been advanced here.
The knife and a bottle of painkillers were found next to the body.
Correct.
And there was some reporting in the New York Times several days ago that other friends that he had talked to didn't give any indication prior to this that, I mean, he was apparently a man who was looking forward to a nice, long, healthy life, and yet, you know, this happened. I'm just curious.
Well, there's no question that Kelly was deeply shaken by having to testify. He appeared strained while testifying. He mumbled and shook his head. He denied, by the way, being the source for the story. As he later said, he hadn't fingered Campbell by name as inserting the 45 minutes. So he felt that maybe there was another source for that part of it.
He was also not a senior intelligence official, which is what he was described as in the report.
Right. He was a 59-year-old career bureaucrat, a man of unblemished reputation, it's worth saying, and somebody who had visited Iraq many times and was deeply involved in this question of weapons of mass destruction. But he did complain about the experience of testifying, and he did seem very shaken by it. He also was a man who was facing some health problems of his own. You know, why someone takes his life is at some level unknowable.
But he left no note or anything.
As far as we know, yeah.
I'll never know. Mm.
Jeff, thanks very much.
All right, you're welcome.
After Mr. Campbell testified today, is he done, by the way?
Yeah, I believe his testimony is finished. I mean, he could be recalled, but he had pretty much wrapped it up by the end of the day.
We will also eventually hear from the Secretary of Defense, Jeffrey Hoon, and, of course, from the Prime Minister himself.
That will be quite a day. The fact is, this is not a trial, and it doesn't have a direct correlation in the U.S. It's not a congressional investigation, and it's not a trial. But it's... And Lord Hutton, the law lord who's in charge of it, calls all the shots. He's the guy who decides how it works, what's going to happen, whether cameras are in the courtroom or not. And by the way, they're not. And the fact that he can tailor this to his own design has allowed it to unfold in a way that has really become, I think, the most intimate look inside the British government that we've ever had. And I'm not sure if it was a trial or a parliamentary inquiry with its own deference, whether it would have quite the same scope and quite the same penetration as it has. But it's really caught this country a bit by surprise in being quite as thorough and unblinking as it's been. As you say, neither Downing Street nor the BBC has escaped from this unscathed. Right now, the polls are saying that about half of the electorate believes that the government deliberately embellished its dossier on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction in an attempt to make the case for war. The BBC comes out a little better, but not much. In fact, only 6% of voters at this point trust the government more than the BBC to tell the truth. So both of them have taken it on the chin. There's been a lot of questioning. I've had questions from friends and colleagues in America of whether Blair is going down as a result of this. And the answer is that nobody knows. One thing he has in his favor is the lack of a credible opponent to take his place. But this thing is heading out, and no one knows quite where it's leading us, which is part of what makes it so exciting.
One question of timing before we have to let you go. When is Prime Minister Blair scheduled to return from his vacation in the Caribbean to testify?
Well, I'm not sure, to tell you the truth, exactly what day he's to take the stand. I believe he comes back at the end of next week. But I'm not, I don't have a date for you on that.
Eric Pooley, thanks very much.
Good to be with you.
Eric Pooley is the editor of Time Magazine Europe. He was with us from his office in London. When we come back from a short break, we're going to continue taking more of your calls as we discuss the British government and the BBC. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email if you'd like. Our address is totn@npr.org. And we're going to focus a little bit more on how the Hutton inquiry will affect the BBC's reputation and its future. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the Hutton Inquiry in Britain, which is investigating the apparent suicide of scientist and former Iraqi weapons inspector David Kelly. The inquiry pits the government of Prime Minister Tony Blair against the BBC, the world's foremost public broadcaster. Joining us now from his home in London is acting Britain editor of The Economist magazine, Edward Lucas, and it's good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Good evening, Neil.
How do you think this scandal has affected the BBC's reputation?
I think it's damaged the BBC's reputation in different ways in different places. I think particularly for people who follow journalism and journalistic practice, it's really rather shocking that a correspondent for the BBC was able to run this story about Dr. Kelly on the basis of an interview with a single anonymous source during which he didn't really take proper notes. And I think the whole basis of BBC journalism has been quite damaged by that. On the other hand, I think that people have who look at the BBC and in the regulatory context as a public service broadcaster that basically is able to regulate itself are worrying why it is that the governors of the BBC, the people who are meant to be, if you like, the non-executive board at the very top of this organisation, why they were so quick to leap to the defence of their journalists without having really looked into the allegations properly, without having really scrutinised them. So I think those are the two big kind of blows that the BBC's taken. I think in the minds of people who are basically anti-Blair, maybe anti-war, anti-Bush, anti-American, I suspect possibly the BBC's reputation's gone up a bit just because they see the BBC as under attack from people they don't like.
There's also the testimony of a second BBC journalist who taped an interview with David Kelly and says, at least in her testimony last week, that she was being pressured by her editors to conform to the earlier Andrew Gilligan report.
That was absolutely remarkable. I think for connoisseurs of sort of political and journalistic theatre, that was really one of the highlights of the whole thing. This journalist is called Susan Watts, and she's the science editor of Newsnight, which is a highbrow late-night television current affairs show. If you imagine the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour, but shown at kind of 11 o'clock at night, that you'd have a rough comparison. Now, there's absolutely no love lost between the Today programme, which is a morning radio current affairs show, and Newsnight. And she really let rip, by implication at Gilligan and directly at her BBC bosses, for their supposed attempts to bully and manipulate her into making her interview with Dr. Kelly corroborate Mr. Gilligan's. But the odd thing was that, in fact, when you listen to the tape, it did sound as though Dr. Kelly had said pretty much the same thing to her as he'd also supposedly, as Mr. Gilligan says he said in the interview with him. And there wasn't really a great deal of difference. And one slightly had the feeling that maybe there was some peak, some sort of professional peak involved that Susan Watts had got the same story from Dr. Kelly but hadn't really noticed it, being perhaps a science specialist rather than a politics specialist, and hadn't realised that the allegation that the government was sexing up the intelligence information about Iraq was actually rather a sensational allegation.
Let's get a phone call. Chris joins us from his car in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air, Chris.
Hi, I have a question. Is the reason why we don't get this kind of journalism in the U.S. From public news sources due to the difference with how they are funded by the government?
Well, can you give us a little bit background to Edward Lucas on how the BBC is funded by the government?
The BBC is funded by what's in effect a tax on televisions. It's about £150-160 per television owning household. So if you have a television at home, you pay that tax.
And I'm doing a quick calculation, about $250.
That's exactly right. Yes, sorry, I was just going to do that myself.
Okay.
And so that's about £5 billion, $8 billion, which the BBC gets as income. And that, in effect, is a state subsidy, because if you don't pay this television tax, and if you do own a television, you can go to court and eventually go to prison. So that's basically the way it's funded.
And the size of this licence fee is set by Parliament, right?
And the size of the licence fee is set by the government. It's reviewed every few years, and the BBC's had a pretty generous deal. And oddly, and this is one of the strange things about this, is that so far during the Blair government, the relationship between the BBC and the government has really been characterised as being unhealthily cosy, that they were basically on the same side. And the Conservative opposition used to criticise the BBC like anything and say, they make fun of us and they're all these kind of soft, left liberal types in the BBC who see eye to eye with the government.
And how about in America? How does that contrast? How funding is...
Well, as I understand it in America, and you probably know this better than me, there's a National Foundation for the Arts, which...
I do know it better than you. I can tell right away. There's the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which gets some money from the government, and the difference in the quantity could be described as a great deal less, which distributes it to public radio and television stations, which then purchase programs from program producers, for example, National Public Radio.
Okay, so then... Basically, the amount that the BBC gets is pretty much set by the number of televisions, and then the amount that...
And the size of the license fee, which is set by the government.
And then, in the contrast in the U.S., it would probably change from administration to administration, which...
Well, to some degree it is. It's supposed to be funded a couple of years in advance, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but there's also other sources of income that public radio and television stations use, and, for example, a foundation support. There's some underwriting support that you hear on your public radio and television stations. And, of course, the majority of the money comes from you, the listener, as we always say.
Uh-huh.
And that's a big difference with Britain, where the listener doesn't contribute anything at all voluntarily. But the BBC does trade as a business, and it makes, by my recollection, getting on for $1 billion or £500,000 through selling programs overseas, some of which you probably see in America on the Discovery Channel and other channels there, where either as co-productions or programs are just bought direct from the BBC.
Let's get another caller, and Ian joins us from St. Anthony in Minnesota.
Yes, hello. I just have a comment and a quick question. My comment is that, all governments, regardless of their superpower or not, such as the U.S. or Great Britain, have a tendency to over-exaggerate the case for war. They did it back in the 60s with Ho Chi Minh, the domino theory, and communism and all that. And, they've done it now with Saddam Hussein and, the weapons for mass destruction. And they haven't found any yet. And they've, combed the entire Iraqi area. And my question is, now that Britain has been shown to have, exaggerated the case for war, how their credibility with the British people has changed or stayed the same or whatnot.
Well, that's ultimately the question, isn't it, Edward Lucas? The credibility of the government is at stake here.
Yeah, and there's a very odd thing about this. We at The Economist went to see Tony Blair more than a year ago. This was before Iraq was anywhere on the agenda. And a time when America was downplaying it, and we asked him, what are you really worried about on the international scene? What should we be looking out for? And he said, I'm really worried about Iraq, because I get to see the intelligence reports, and I think it's really scary what they're doing. And he had no reason to say this to us other than that it was true, or at least he believed it to be true. So way before George Bush was worried about Iraq, Tony Blair was worried about Iraq. He was worried about Iraq because of what the intelligence services warned him that Iraq was trying to do. And I myself was based as a correspondent in Moscow then, and it was no secret there that the Iraqis were going around the former Soviet Union trying to buy all sorts of dubious and dangerous things. And the really puzzling thing is that when Tony Blair actually went to war, was going to war in Iraq, and he went to the intelligence services and said, I want to publish some of this intelligence, what they could provide him with wasn't enough or wasn't suitable to be published. And we then got into this business of publishing a dossier on this really very flimsy evidence with uranium being bought from Niger in Africa and the claim that weapons could be ready in 45 minutes when they clearly weren't and so on. Mm-hmm. And I find that the really most puzzling aspect of the whole affair, the difference between the extremely alarmist intelligence before and the rather indifferent stuff that was produced when they were actually trying to make the case for war.
Ian, thanks very much for the call. The David Kelly scandal is affecting, of course, members of Tony Blair's own party, the Labour Party members, some of them very much caught in the middle. Joining us now is Labour Party member and member of Parliament, George Fox, and very, very nice of you to join us today.
Great pleasure to join you, Neil. Good evening.
Good evening. Do you think that this inquiry has damaged the government of Tony Blair?
I don't think it's helped the government, but I think the very fact that the inquiry was set up by the government within 3 hours of the death of Dr. Kelly showed a government acting quickly and fairly. And I think the fact that it is dealing, I think, very well, both the council acting on behalf of Lord Hutton and Lord Hutton himself are getting to the questions and dealing with the subject, which is the death of Dr. Kelly. I'm afraid the coverage in the British media is going beyond that and really going back to the justification for the war and using the evidence that comes forward on that basis rather than on the question of why Dr. Kelly committed suicide.
Yes, indeed. Do you think that this inquiry has in fact become a symbolic investigation into the decision to go to war?
I think the media are trying to make it that in the United Kingdom. But you see, they're focusing on one part of one dossier. And I voted for the United Kingdom to join in the war, and not because of one part of one dossier. I voted for a whole variety of reasons, but particularly because the Iraqi government flouted the United Nations again and again and again, because they took no notice of Resolution 1441, because of their appalling human rights record, and because of the threat they posed. And I made that judgment not on the basis of one dossier, but on the basis of a whole series of facts from Hans Blix, from the UN, from a whole range of sources that we got in the run-up to making that decision. And I think the concentration on this particular part of one dossier is perverse.
The decision to go to war and Prime Minister Blair's determination to do so was unpopular at the time. Will his political future eventually come to ride on the question of whether weapons of mass destruction are indeed found in Iraq? After none were found in the early weeks, he said those who say there weren't any would have to eat their words.
Well, I mean, anyone who says that there were no weapons of mass destruction is indeed deluded, because he invaded Iran, he invaded Kuwait, he killed hundreds of thousands of his own people. So and we know he had weapons of mass destruction. Otherwise, why did he not want the UN inspectors to go back in? It's whether or not he has been able to hide them beyond our ability to find them. And I think the inspectors will find evidence that there were weapons of mass destruction and that they were able to be deployed. Now, whether it was within 45 minutes or within a particular period of time, or what he's done with them or how he's been able to hide them, is something that is open for proof and examination. But no doubt, there's no doubt in my mind that he had weapons of mass destruction. He used them regularly.
What about the other side of this, what's become this argument between the government and the BBC? How is this going to affect the British Broadcasting Corporation as its charter comes up for renewal?
Well, you see, the BBC, as you know, is very different from all other broadcasting outlets in the United Kingdom and from all other media in the United Kingdom. As you were saying on your program earlier, I get taxed £112, that's what, $180, is it, every year to pay for the BBC. And it therefore has an obligation to be fair, accurate and impartial in all its outlets. And that's a very strong obligation, one which the ITN doesn't have, which the newspapers don't have. And what we had here, the genesis of this whole Hutton inquiry, was this Gilligan report, Andrew Gilligan, who gave what is now admitted by the BBC to be a sloppy report, an inaccurate and, I believe, mischievous report, saying that Number 10 had sexed up that document. And I think that was a very, very unfortunate thing that the BBC, through all its outlets, then broadcast and rebroadcast and magnified and built up this report. And then the director of news, the director general, and the governors all backed up this one sloppy report. And I think that was a very bad misjudgment by the BBC and all its organs.
Well, again, what's the effect going to be having in Parliament?
Well, a lot of my colleagues are saying we need to review the charter of the BBC, which is coming up. We need to look at whether or not the license fee is an appropriate way of funding if the BBC isn't going to be acting in a fair, accurate and impartial way. And recently, the reports in the BBC have not helped its case for continuing to have its charter, to have its guaranteed income in the way that it has in the past. Now, I would like to see it continue, but I must say they're not helping themselves.
George Fox, thanks you very much for being with us tonight.
Great pleasure to talk with you.
MP George Fox is a member of the Labour Party. He was with us from his home office in Ayr in Scotland. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Edward Lucas of The Economist magazine is still with us, and our phone number is still 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, TOTN at NPR.org. And let's go to Deborah, who joins us from Sanibel Island in Florida.
Yes, I'm curious as to why there's more scrutiny of British press than there is of the American press dealing with the situation in Iraq and nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction.
Why did this come to become such a, well, you'll excuse the expression, thermonuclear issue in the British media?
Yeah.
Let's ask Edward Lucas.
Well, I think there's two reasons, really. One is that despite what Mr. Fuchs said, there was a really big issue in Britain in the run-up to the war, which was that the intelligence services were deeply unhappy about the way in which the government was overstating the case. And I myself know people who were entirely in favor of the war. They thought it was right that we were going to get rid of Saddam Hussein. They just didn't like the way in which the intelligence was being exaggerated, because they thought rightly it would probably boomerang back and discredit the enterprise overall. And so there was so although I can quite see that people like Mr. Fuchs voted for the war for a number of reasons, the fact is that at least in a couple of important respects, the government's case for war was based on information which was at best exaggerated or at worst outright distorted. So that left a kind of nasty, if you like, a nasty itch on the body politic that needed scratching. And then the second thing is that Dr. Kelly killed himself, and the death of someone, distinguished public servant, also leaves a very unpleasant atmosphere behind it. And there's a big question about whether he was bullied, was he put under extraordinary pressure, what was going on in those days in between his testimony to Parliament and to the and his committing suicide. And those are two really big questions which are pretty specific to Britain, I think. I'm not sure that anything like that's been coming up in the United States, so hence the extreme interest.
We just have about 30 seconds left with you, but how much is going to hinge on Tony Blair's performance when he does testify before this inquiry?
I don't think much will hinge on Tony Blair's performance. That would be sort of interesting, dramatic. I think the really important thing is John Scarlett, who's the head of intelligence at number 10 Downing Street, and is an extremely interesting guy. He's only been photographed once in public. He's a real sort of traditional career secret agent, very interesting, and we will be looking with extreme attention to see how he explains his part in all this.
Edward Lucas, thanks very much for being with us. Edward Lucas is the acting Britain editor of The Economist magazine. He was on the phone with us from his home in London. Coming up after a short break, tired of all the ads on network television? Well, here's an idea, mini-movies. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.